Good morning. It's a great day to be together, in part because we have our friends here from Indonesia to share about their ministry and for us to deepen our partnership and connection with them. That's special, but it's also special because this is our last Sunday in Exodus. We've spent the last 12 Sundays diving into the second book of the Bible, and I think it's been a really powerful way to kind of go through the story. And back on week one in mid-February, I talked about how part of the reason why I think Exodus is so captivating is because it's really the story that's underneath so many of the popular stories of our day, like Star Wars and Harry Potter and Dune. Those of you that saw Dune 2 just a few months ago, and Shrek, and lots of other movies. The Matrix, I wrote down as an Exodus-like story. It's the foundation for all these stories, I think in part because it taps into like the deepest longings that we have for freedom, for liberation from evil, to feel like we're living in the blessing and provision of God and to sense His work coming underneath us. And so we've traced these themes all throughout our series that we called Hope in the Wilderness. And we traced the hope that the people of Israel could have even when they were enslaved and being killed by Pharaoh and the Egyptian people. We traced it through the midwives, the Hebrew midwives, and Moses' mom, Jochebed, and sister, Miriam. And then Moses spending 40 years in Midian and then meeting the Lord through the burning bush at Mount Sinai, and then going back to Egypt to really be an instrument of change and to be kind of the bringer of God's power through the 10 plagues, including the Passover event, and then the deliverance of God's people through the Red Sea. And they're delivered into this place, and they start complaining, and God provides bread in the wilderness and water from a rock and quail on the desert floor. And then we continue to trace these themes of God forming a people as we looked at the Ten Commandments and then the giving of the tabernacle as God dwelling with His people. And then we looked at how all of this kind of comes to a culmination and like God's people should be for the Lord. And then we looked at the golden calf story last Sunday and how these people that God had been so instrumental in carrying them through could abandon Him and rebel against Him and be disobedient toward Him. And the question that we were kind of left with hanging at the end of last Sunday is like, well, what happens next? Like, God had done all these things, and the people had gone their own way, and God had given a consequence, and like, what's going to happen? Are they just going to kind of part ways? What's the next part? And so you could continue on the story, Exodus 33, the very beginning part of the next section right after the golden calf, the aftermath of it, is that God and Moses are having a conversation. And God says to Moses, I'm going to give you guys everything you ever wanted. Like this desert place, Mount Sinai, this is kind of like an in-between season. But I'm going to give you the greatest home that you could ever imagine. A home with flowing with milk and honey. It's going to be everything that you ever wanted. And it's kind of like the question that maybe God would ask you, like, if God could give you everything that you ever wanted, but God said, oh, by the way, I'm not going to be a part of that, would you say yes? That's essentially what God said to the people. I'm going to give you the land that has everything that you ever wanted, but I'm not going to go with you. You're going there by yourself. Would you say yes? And if you know the story of Exodus, as you've been here over the last 12 weeks, and you look at the golden calf story, you're kind of like, well, I think the people probably said no, right? Like, they're rebellious, they want to go their own way. But the first part of Exodus 33, verse 4, the people say something that I think is rather surprising. It says this, when the people heard these distressing words, they began to mourn. Now, why are they mourning? They're mourning because they have recognized through their rebellion, through the consequence of their sin, they've repented of that and have turned back to the Lord. And they're saying to God, like, you could give us everything that we ever wanted, but if you're not a part of it, we don't want it. That's essentially what they're saying to God. They're mourning because they realize how meaningless life is without the Lord walking with them. It kind of reminds me of something I heard in a podcast interview with Shaquille O'Neal just a few months ago. He was being interviewed. Shaquille O'Neal is a famous NBA basketball player who's retired and older now. But he was asked, like, what advice do you give to younger players as they're coming into the league in the NBA? And he said, I tell them, don't be like me. Shaq lived it up when he was an NBA player. And now, as he's older and retired, he went on to say in the interview that he goes home to a 50,000 square foot house that's empty. And his advice to the younger players is, don't be like me. What Shaq realized, and what I think the Israelite people realize, is like a life without a purpose with other people and before the Lord is a rather meaningless endeavor. And that's what the Israelites have started to figure out. And from this place of understanding, Moses goes to the Lord and he says, hey, we want you to be a part of whatever it is that you're carrying us to next. And then God goes on and he begins to explain about who he is. Who is this God that the people are saying they want to unite themselves to again? And God explains about who he is. Now, I would imagine that if you kind of go around and have conversations with people and you ask them, what do you think God is like? You would have some people who would say, well, God is loving, God is wise, God is infinite. But then you would have other people that, you know, are more jaded toward God, don't believe in him, or struggle with his reality. And they would maybe say God is angry, or God is an illusion, or maybe God is distant, or God is a tyrant or a judge. They might describe God in those ways. Well, I think this question of what is God like is actually really important. And I think one of the ways that I understand that is through a quote from A.W. Tozer, which really informs my thinking about this. He says, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. And I don't think that's an overstatement. How we understand who God is shapes our lives in dramatic ways. Think about the ways that we react to things in life, the behaviors that we take on in life are largely shaped by our view of God. If you think of God as untrustworthy, you will feel anxious in life. If you see God as a judge or as a tyrant, as I mentioned before, you will feel insecure because you'll always be worried if you measure up, if you're good enough. If you think God is distant, far off, then you'll feel insignificant because he's so far away. And if you think God is angry, over time, you're going to become irritable because that's how you see God. So you respond in the same way. What comes into your mind when you think about God is the most important thing about you. But here's like my general principle, overarching idea. I think God is different than you expect. God is different than you expect. And we're going to jump into the middle of Exodus 33, and we're going to look at God's description for himself. And I bet there's going to be aspects of this that for us that are surprising. And so if you have a Bible, you could turn to Exodus 33. We're going to start at verse 18. And we're going to start right in the middle of a conversation that God and Moses are having. God and Moses are talking about how the people want God to be their God. And they want him more than they want the place that he's going to take them to. And so Moses and God are talking about this. And we pick it up in verse 18. And we're going to read even into the beginning of chapter 34. It says, then Moses said, now show me your glory. And why Moses is saying this is he's basically saying, like, I want you to show me who you are so that I can trust that you're going to be the God for these people. And the Lord said in response, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. Then the Lord said, there is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in the cleft put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen." The Lord said to Moses, "Chisel out two stone tablets like the first ones, and I will write on them the words that were on the first tablets which you broke. Be ready in the morning, and then come up on Mount Sinai. Present yourself to me there on top of the mountain. No one is to come with you or be seen anywhere on the mountain. Not even the flocks and herds may graze in front of the mountain." So Moses chiseled out two stone tablets like the first ones and went up Mount Sinai early in the morning as the Lord had commanded him. And he carried the two stone tablets in his hands. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, the Lord. And he passed in front of Moses proclaiming, "The Lord, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation." Moses bowed to the ground at once and worshiped. "Lord," he said, "if I have found favor in your eyes, then let the Lord go with us. Although this is a stiff-necked people, forgive our wickedness and our sin and take us as your inheritance." This is the word of the Lord. I think one helpful thing in just reading through this section that would help this become more understandable, this passage, is to think of what we talked about last week, Exodus 32, all the way through what we just read, Exodus 34, as one unit together. Because I think when you focus too much on just one individual part, you can begin to misunderstand God. Part of what I mean by that is the end of Exodus 32 that we looked at last Sunday. God sends a plague on his people because God is angry and frustrated at their disobedience. And if you were just to only look at that story, you would come to the conclusion that God is an angry tyrant. But never, even in the midst of providing a consequence for the people's sin, did God stop being loving and stop being faithful. He was all of those things, even in the midst of his frustration with the people. But to really understand this passage that we just read, you have to understand it first as a renewal of the covenant that God has with his people. And that's the first part that I put in the notes. This is about the covenant of God. And it says it very obviously to us in verse 1 of chapter 34. "The Lord said to Moses, chisel out two stone tablets like the first ones, and I will write on them the words that were on the first tablets which you broke." So in the section that we just read, this passage, we start off with Moses and God having this conversation about God being the God for these people. And he's asked, "Would you show me your glory?" It's like, give me a sign. Show me yourself so that I can feel confident about this relationship moving forward. It's like, blow me away, God. Do something to surprise me. And God says, sure, I'll do something. Why don't you go stand on that rock over there, and my presence is going to come up, and I'm going to place you down in the rock, and I'm going to cover you completely. So not a ray of light from my glory can touch you, because if it touches you, you're going to die. Nobody can see me and live. And I'll pass over you, and then you can stand up, and you can look, and you can see my backside, because nobody can see my face and live. How's that for a sign? How does that sound? Well, then it continues on, and it gets to this part, which I'm describing here as the covenant, because we have two tablets that are talked about here in verse 1, which should immediately in our minds take us back to Exodus 20, when we looked at the Ten Commandments, where God took two stone tablets, and he, with his own hand, wrote out the Ten Commandments on these two stone tablets. And when we looked at these Ten Commandments, we talked about how, why would there be two tablets? There would be two tablets because it was a covenant. It was a covenant meant to, one group would take one tablet, the other group, God, would take the other tablet, and they would both keep their aspect to remind themselves of what they had agreed to. But interestingly enough, in Exodus, God takes both tablets and he puts them underneath the Ark of the Covenant. It's as if God is saying to the people, like, this covenant is based on me. I will bring it about. It's reliant upon me. And we even see this in the way the Ten Commandments were given in Exodus 20. Before they're given, God says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of slavery. And then the Ten Commandments follow. And what we see here is that it is God's character that is rooted in his commands. They become a reflection of who he is. So we have these two tablets in Exodus 20. And you fast forward to last week, Exodus 32. And Moses has these two tablets and he's coming down the mountain. And he sees the people worshiping a golden calf. And he throws the tablets to the ground. And they shatter into a bunch of pieces. And it's this symbolic representation of what the people had done to the covenant that they had made with God. They had shattered it. They'd broken it. They had very obviously broken commandments 1 and 2 in their worship of the golden calf. And so then here we are in Exodus 34. And I think Moses is trying to draw a parallel for us to what happened in Exodus 20, because there's so many similarities. God says to Moses, come up in the morning. And God says to the people, nobody else can be on the mountain. No animals, no nothing. Nothing on the mountain, only me and Moses. And he comes up and he goes up the mountain in the morning. And so we see these connections here between Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments, the giving of God's covenant with these people, and Exodus 34, the renewal of this covenant with God's people. And I cannot overstate how significant this is, but I don't think it just jumps off the page to us to where we understand the significance of what is happening. And I think the best way that I could explain how important what is happening right here is with a story. A story that would be like this. A husband is married to a wife, and he is unfaithful to her. He is unfaithful to her emotionally. He is unfaithful to her physically. And at one point, she even walks in on him being unfaithful. And the husband is remorseful, and he recognizes his sin and the way that he has hurt her. And he goes and he apologizes, and he asks her to take him back. Not only does he ask her to take him back, he says, I want to be the most important person in your life. I want to be the apple of your eye. I want to be the joy of your life. I am it when it comes to your life. So he's kind of making big demands, right? Like, not only is he asking for forgiveness, he's kind of saying, like, I want to be the most important person in your life. Now, this woman comes to any one of us and says, like, well, what do you think? What should I do? I think we could go around the room. I bet almost 100% of us would be like, I don't know. Like, that guy would, you know, he's got to at least earn some trust. You're going to take him back and you're going to say, like, I'll give everything to you? Like, I don't know if I'd do that. That's a little risky. You're probably going to get hurt. I don't think that's going to work out. We would all be very skeptical and concerned for obvious reasons. But that is essentially what is happening here in Exodus 34. The Israelites are the unfaithful husband who are asking God not just to take him back, but to make them the most important person to the Lord, to provide in all sorts of ways. And Moses even says it in verse 10, to make them his inheritance. And what does God say? He is the wife in this story. God says, yes. He says, yes, I'll take you back, and you will be the most important person to me. That's what God does. I cannot overstate how significant that is. That is what God says to you and I in our sinfulness. Will you take me back? God says yes. And he says yes in a very specific way. He gives his name. And that's the second part, the name of God. We see it in verse 6. God is standing before Moses in the cloud on the mountain, and he says, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. Verses 6 and 7 in Exodus 34 are the most quoted passage in the entire Bible. In the Old Testament alone, it's either referenced or quoted 27 times. This is God giving his name, just like he did back in Exodus 3 when he was in the burning bush speaking to Moses. He again gives his name. But again, this is a covenant ceremony that's happening with him and Moses. And so what we think is, like, God's renewing the covenant. What should he do? He should write the Ten Commandments again, right? But instead, what he does is he gives his name. He describes his character instead. And what it reminds us of is that his demands are rooted in his character. What he's asking for us is to become a reflection of who he actually is. And he does this by giving his name, Yahweh, the Lord, as it's translated in the NIV. And we talked many weeks ago about Yahweh as a word that means, I will be who I will be. It's not only a name, it's a description of who God is. And then God even goes further and explains even more about who is I will be, who I will be. Well, this is what he's like. He is the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. That's who he is. And of these descriptions, there's a couple of them that stand out to me because of the way that they're written in the original language. The first is what we translate to compassionate. Compassionate is a feminine adjective for womb, which would obviously be a noun. And what I mean by that is this is an action word that's meant to function like a woman's womb as they carry a baby. God is describing himself in terms of motherly care and affection for a child. That's what it means that God is compassionate. And then the other one that's really interesting to me is that it says that he's slow to anger. And the words used in the original language are literally long nostrils. God has long nostrils. And what it's supposed to be is a picture of somebody who is slow to anger. Somebody who has short nostrils, they have a quick fuse. They're quick to become angry. Somebody who has a long nostril, so if you have a long nose, you're welcome. It's a compliment, apparently, according to God. So those are two aspects of his description that are interesting. But the most interesting piece of this whole interaction to me is what is not said. Moses is writing about this experience that he has with God on the mountain. And God has already described that I'm going to place you in the cleft of the rock. My glory is going to pass over you. You're going to see my backside. Now they're here and God is in the cloud and they're having a conversation. And the only thing that Moses writes about is what God says. That's it. Now, I don't know about you, but if I had this kind of transcendent experience with God, where God and I are like almost face to face and I see the backside of the glory of God, I would tell you all about the difference that it made in my life and what the experience was like. It would be so vivid in my memory. I could tell you everything about it. But that's not what Moses does. Moses just gives simply the words that God said on the mountain. That's all he does. And what I think we see here is just this simple principle. A true encounter with God leads to a God-centered life. I think that's what's happening here with Moses. Moses probably had all sorts of ways that this impacted his life, but he is so now focused on the Lord that his life and his response pales in comparison to who God is. I've heard it described that the Bible, God's word, is God's love letter to us. And I think that's a very weak understanding of what the Bible actually is. The Bible is not God's love letter to us. It is a story about who God is. Just like we don't invite Christ into our lives, God invites us to be a part of what he is doing. And that's a subtle difference, but it's a massive difference. Because when we invite God into our lives, we're the center of the story. But when God invites us into his, he is the center of the story. And we see that happening here with Moses. Back about 10 years ago, I wrote a book, which many of you have read. If you've gotten a welcome bag, we include a copy of my book called, titled Why Holiness Matters, is in there. And if this is your first time and you don't have a welcome bag, like, you got to get one on the way out. So I wrote this book. It came out in 2012, and it came out the exact same day as another writer who was writing with the same publishing house as I was writing with. And I kind of knew, like, this guy's got more readers on his blog. He's got more followers on social media. Like, I am not going to be able to sell as many copies as him, and I bet the publisher's not going to be happy about it. And sure enough, 3 weeks or so after the book released, the publisher said, hey, you know, Jeff's doing really well, the guy who wrote the other book. Maybe you should talk to him about, like, what he's doing that's working to sell his books. So I'm like, okay, sure enough, Jeff and I can have a conversation. So Jeff and I talk on the phone, and Jeff is like, so you wrote this book on holiness. You know what I think you need to do is you just need to make it a little bit more practical. Like, what difference is holiness going to make in the lives of people? And I was like, wait, hold on. Like, that's the whole reason I wrote the book, is because it's not practical. To be made holy is to have a God-centered focus on your life. It's not about us and becoming better people or more efficient. It's us being a reflection of the God that has invaded and overtaken our lives. And so the conversation didn't go very well, as you can tell. I didn't really take his advice. But what it reminded me of is the temptation to make a God life all about actually us. There's a temptation to make this church, coming to church, it's all about us. And really, I think the invitation and the example of Moses is that it's all about God. I think of what it says in John 3:30, he must increase, I must decrease. I need to make much of him and make less of me. That's what Moses is an example of. And then the last part that I want to emphasize here, when God is describing himself, is in verse 7, the very next verse, which I think shows what we might call the contradiction of God. Verse 7, God is continuing to describe who he is, and he says, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. So we're going to talk about the contradiction in a second. But we have to first talk about the very end of verse 7. Punishing the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. Now, I don't know about you, but I have questions about that verse. And my main question is, like, does that mean that the sin of my great-grandparents is somehow causing punishment from God to fall on me? That's really the question that we're asking based on the end of verse 7. What this cannot mean is that God is punishing innocent and godly people for sins that they did not commit. It cannot mean that, in part because in Deuteronomy 24, God even very specifically says that he punishes people based on the things that they have done, that each person is responsible for the things that they have done, not what others have done before them. And so each generation is responsible. And I think we could say it in this way. Rather, what God has in mind is that God will punish each generation for committing the same sin that parents and grandparents committed by committing the same one. They are not blameless simply because it got passed down to them and now they're partaking in it does not abstain the blame from them. It still falls on them. But those who are innocent and aren't partakers of the thing that was passed down to them, that the punishment does not fall on them. And what I think we see here is that you then are responsible for breaking the cycle of sin and dysfunction that you inherited. Many of you have had horrible things happen to you by those who have come before. many of you have had horrible things just by being in the church. And you've inherited some awful things. And God grieves the things that have happened to you. But God also empowers you to take up the mantle of setting a new course moving forward. And he wants to honor and bless that, to allow the dysfunction and the sin to be broken off with you in your life. You're responsible for carrying that forward. And so that's the confusing part of verse 7, but it doesn't take away the contradiction. The contradiction is very simply that God is loving in the first half of verse 7, and that God is holy, judging sin in the second half of verse 7. So how can it be that God is both holy and loving at the same time? It's a contradiction that in some ways we have to hold in tension. I think of it as, I'm a guitar player, I think of it like a guitar string. A guitar string that is too loose will sound terrible. You'd never want to hear it played. And a guitar string that is tightened too tight will break. It won't be able to hold the tension. And so what we're really called to do is to hold two truths in tension that exist together at the same time. Just like a guitar string that holds tension can make a beautiful sound. It's the same thing. In his book on the Christian faith throughout history, a secular historian, Tom Holland, wrote a book called Dominion. And he talks about how Jewish people were coming to the Christian faith. And he talks about it in terms of the contradiction of God. He says, Jews who pondered the evidence of their scriptures never doubted that he was a deity, a God, with whom it was possible to have a profoundly personal relationship. But the key to his identity, vivid though it was, lay in its manifold contradictions. God is a warrior who in his wrath might panic armies, annihilate cities, and command the slaughter of entire peoples. But God, he also raised the poor from the dust and the needy from the dung heaps. That is who God is. He is a contradiction. And there is a beauty and a tension to the contradiction of who God is. And we see it come to its fullness and its fulfillment after Exodus in Jesus. And John, in his gospel, he describes Jesus in these kind of contradictory terms using Exodus language. In John 1:14, he says, "The Word became flesh and dwelled, it tabernacled among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." Another contradiction, grace and truth. So John has used Exodus language. God wants to dwell or tabernacle among us. We have seen his glory. We just looked at Moses asking God to show his glory. So Jesus is the glory of God, and he exists full of grace and truth. And then the contradiction continues to play out when John in verse 18, just a few verses later, John 1:18 says, "No one has ever seen God, not even Moses," right? Exodus 33, "Nobody can see me and live. But the one and only Son, Jesus, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known." The contradiction of God comes to its fulfillment in Jesus. And when we see Jesus, we're given a glimpse of who God is. Not even Moses could see God. Any sinner who looks at God is struck down, dead. We cannot survive in the presence of God. Of the glory of God. How do we survive then? How do we move forward in relationship with God? Is, well, we need Jesus. We need Jesus. We need the one who never sinned to absorb the punishment and the condemnation for our sin. And we see in Jesus the holiness and the love of God come together. We see the holiness of God because God is infinitely holy and he punishes sin. It cannot stand in his presence. And we see the love of God because it is in Jesus. He absorbed that punishment so that we could experience forgiveness. In Jesus, we see the contradiction of God. The holiness and love of God come together. It is by the righteous one dying and taking on the penalty of the sin that we have committed, by him taking that on, that we could experience life. And how do we do this? Well, Peter says in Acts 2, as he's preaching about Jesus, he says, "Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved." How do you have relationship with God in which you cannot stand, you cannot even be seen by him, and you will be struck dead? Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. That's how we stand in the presence of the Lord, not by our own doing, but through what Christ has done. And I think the invitation for us from Exodus 34 is to make the name of God the first thing on our lips. And our society would say the first thing on your lips is to make much of yourself. Build up your name, your notoriety. Allow your fame to make you money. Make much of what you can do in this life. But what Exodus 34 is this reminder of us to make much of the name of the Lord. This isn't a formula where we just call out the name of the Lord and then we're saved. We make much of the name of the Lord by declaring that he is the one who saves, and he is the one that is first on our lips, the focus of our lives. That is really the testimony of the book of Exodus. It's about the name of the Lord. And we've seen his name championed and celebrated as he lifts out and carries his people. And how he's done that with us, carried us through. And now the challenge or the encouragement that God gives is, make my name the first name on your lips. And one of the ways that we do that is partaking of communion, of allowing this meal to nourish our souls. And I thought it would be fitting on this last Sunday in Exodus to have all women help distribute the communion elements, in part because you might remember back in Exodus 1 and 2 how we talked about it was women who saved the world. It was the Hebrew midwives. It was Moses' mother, his sister. Their faith in the midst of adversity allowed a deliverance to come through Moses for the Israelite people. And so Mary Jean and Shar and Anna and Hannah are all going to help distribute the elements as they help us experience the deliverance that God gives us through Christ. So I invite the four of you to come up. As they're distributing the elements, I encourage you just to hold on to the cup. Both elements are in that one cup, the bread and the juice, and then we'll partake all together as Yana and Rose lead us in a song.